Everybody, it's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 64th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We'll be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Thank you for that, as always, and please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
So that was a brief outtake from The Who's song, Eminence Front. About people putting on fronts and pretending to be people they're not, and sometimes people do that to the degree that they forget who the real person is. And since we're talking about separating the action from the actor, the art from the artist, I thought that would be kind of a nice intro for us.
Marvelous. Yes, thank you. As Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled Separating Art from the Artist, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin tonight's topic discussion, let's go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Well, tonight's story, harkens back to an event that happened in the late 60s and continued through the 70s with this particular individual. So the event happens to be Woodstock, the original one. And the individual I'm going to be talking about tonight is Corky Laing, whom some of our listeners may know if you are a devotee of the rock band Mountain, as I am. He was the drummer for Mountain, and also the drummer for Wes Brucen Laing, obviously. and has gone on to be a big monkey-to-monk in CBS Records, and still gets together with Elizabeth West from time to time to re-enervate the Mountain saga. So, although there was, as many people may or may not know, Mountain was played at Woodstock, but everybody thinks Corky Laing was the drummer for Mountain at Woodstock, and he was not. The guy that did the first studio record, Leslie West Mountain, which Felix Pappalardi, the bass player, vocalist, whatever, who also produced all the Cream records. The first Leslie West album is called Leslie West Mountain, which is the band came from that. And the drummer on that recording was a guy named Andy Smart, who was actually the person that played at Woodstock. But people think Corky Laing played because when the first official Mountain record came out, which is Mountain Climbing, that had Mississippi Queen and, you know, all those great tunes off of it, Never in My Life, Free Asgard's Farm, and cover of Jack Bruce's theme from An Imaginary Western, which is one of my all-time favorite songs. Corky Laing, by that time, was the drummer for Mountain. So he had replaced Andy Smart because of his association with Felix. Felix met Corky when he was doing a stint with Ahmet Artigan, who is the guy, of course, most people know from Led Zeppelin. And he was looking to sign a band at the time, and the manager of Corky Laing was also Felix's manager, and he was trying to broker a deal, and, hey, we'll do all this stuff if, you know, we'll give you this band if you do this band, and, you know, we got this great producer. So he goes in, so he allows Felix to go in the studio, and he says, hey, I want you to produce this song and, you know, wow me with it, and if you do it, we'll give you the gig. And so he got the gig, he wowed him, got the gig, and remembered Corky Laing, who was playing drums with him at that gig. Well, in the meantime, he had gotten to know Corky to prep for all the gig and all this kind of stuff. And Corky had a band originally called Energy. Well, most of you may not know, Corky's originally a Canuck. He's not from Brooklyn. Forget about it. He's originally from Canada. So he's an import. And he had a band in Canada called Energy. And he had co-authored a song called Who Am I But You in the Sun, which was kind of a hippie-esque kind of dilly. And Felix liked it and got Leslie involved with it because he was also doing the Leslie West Mountain record. And they kind of reworked it and came out and played that song at Woodstock, but changed the title to honor Max Yasger, whose farm they were doing Woodstock on. And so the title of the song changed from Who Am I But You in the Sun to Free Asgard's Farm. And, of course, the opening line for Free Asgard's Farm is Who Am I But You in the Sun. So when a gold record came out for that, you know, the knock comes at the door and Corky Laing gets the gold record, even though he was never at Woodstock because he was the co-author of the song. The other thing Woodstock that he didn't write a song for, didn't play at Woodstock, but ended up doing the remix on drums because the drum mic mucked up when they were recording 10 years after Going Home. So, as you may or may not know, that's an incredibly long tune that gets dragged out for like, you know, 19, 20 minutes. I mean, it's really, really, really long. And the drums on that, the mic was not working, so when they went to mix it in the studio, they had no drummer. So they went next door and said, hey, can we borrow this guy for a minute? And Corky comes over there and he says, hey, can you play this song? You know, and so it's actually Corky Laing playing drums on the song for 10 years after playing Going Home on the Woodstock recording, which also went gold. And so he gets another knock on the door and gets a gold record for that. And this is from a guy who was never at Woodstock, but everybody thinks he was at Woodstock. So that's how the myth kind of got started. But yeah, but he did write, you know, part of the song for Yasker's Farm, and he did play drums on Going Home, Going Home, yeah. So that's the story about Corky Laing.
Okay, thank you for that. Again, we are taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until about midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All righty. Tonight's show is called Separating Art from the Artist. Well, at first glance, this seems to be more of an ethics question than one of psychology. We'll be looking at the psychological aspects of why this is an important principle for many people, while others seemingly feel it's not even important. No matter on whichever side of the question one may fall, the topic provokes a great deal of passion and vehemence of stance. We will examine this concept through the lens of psychology and a bit from ethics and sociological considerations. Our purpose is not to make one side of the stance or the other the finally determined correct one, but to explore the factors that go into choosing and why this choice is so strong for many people. What is psychologically and emotionally at stake in the decision? So tonight we are going to discuss, what does it mean to separate the art from the artist? Is it feasible to be able to do so? Why is this such an important ethical hill to die on for many people? Why do we feel so strongly about making our patronage or stances clear? Under what circumstances should one do this, if ever? What if those they harmed forgave them? Is it a different answer if the artist is merely unpleasant or rude, you know, stuck up, diva attitude, versus actively harming someone, committing assault, rape, or other crimes? Do we take the same level of rigor with persons at any other jobs, our regular shops? Why or why not? And what if the sins, quote, or transgressions were a product of a time period or culture? Ethical relativism. Does this change anything? Does the obligation change when the artist dies or was already dead ages earlier? And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you want to mention up front before we get started.
No, I think we should just dive into it.
All righty. I'm good with diving. All right, so first and foremost, what does it mean to separate the art from the artist? We hear this a lot. So when researching this topic online, posts and websites on this question are divided. It's somewhat a matter of opinion rather than provable fact, or at least some people believe it is possible and some do not. Of those who do, there's a further divide between those who feel we can and should, and some who feel it's unnecessary or frivolous. So we are not here to try and make a final determination on that matter. Rather, let's explain what the concept is, possible or not, and discuss why society raises this issue so often, what this is to us from a psychological standpoint. So by definition, to separate art from the artist means to appreciate and patronize any sort of art or media completely on its own isolated merit, and give no thought to any opinions on the character, ethics, or likability of the artist who produces the art. I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, before we go to the next point.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a nature of the beast, in the sense that we, as people, seem to like to equate the product with the creator. And, you know, I just think it's a way for us to personalize the action and to identify better with it. It's easier for us to identify with another human than it is to identify with an inanimate object such as a play, a guitar, you know, a piece of music, a great, you know, sport maneuver. It's like, oh, this is the person that did the sport maneuver, therefore they are the sport maneuver, so to speak. And I think it's just, it's an easier way for us to appreciate the action by equating it with the actor. It's kind of a cheaty thing we do because we're basically lazy. And it's easy for us to do.
Yeah, fair enough. And we are going to poke at that a little bit more later on. I have a specific question about our behavior in that regard.
Okay.
So, all right, the next point I want to poke at is it feasible to be able to do so, to be able to separate them? So opinions differ on this, and I'm going to say this a lot tonight, so I need you guys just to understand that that is the nature of the topic we're poking at, so I'm going to be saying it quite frequently. Psychologically, it's possible and feasible for some people should they wish to do so, and it may be difficult for others. There's no correct answer for this aspect. It's somewhat of a mentally sophisticated process to be able to receive and appreciate a work of art, produced by somebody that someone finds reprehensible as a person in some way. It's going to be likely driven by how personally meaningful the art is to the individual. If it is a song, movie, book, dance, or any other work which holds deep personal meaning, nostalgia, or sentimentality to it, the person is much more likely to be unwilling to give the work up, even if they feel the need to protest or even punish the artist for some ethical reason. And I'm going to check in and see if you have anything to add to that, Dr. Mathis.
No, I think that's absolutely true. Anytime we make an emotional investment in something, either positively or negatively, it's very hard to let that go once you get the amygdala and hippocampus involved, because they tend to, unfortunately, all too often supersede the prefrontals. And that's just an unfortunate thing that we as humans seem to do much too often, in my opinion. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yep, absolutely. And we're going to be poking that a lot tonight. Just, you know, poking at the aspects of this blanket topic and all the different ways it comes up. So the next point I want to poke is, why is this such an important ethical hill to die on for many people? Why do we feel so strongly about making our patronage or stances clear? So currently, and in recent years, probably a decade or less, the immediacy and ease of social media, plus the timing of our societal climate of confession of wrongs done and received of late, whether voluntarily or outed by others, has created a tone where such information is no longer being covered up, at least to the extent it has been before now. This has been true in all walks of life, but it seems to be far more rampant in the arts and entertainment industries. Other than politics, there really is no other equivalent workplace environment that is so conducive to this sort of behavior being both common and running unchecked or excused and covered up. You have persons who may become rich and famous overnight and are therefore granted close to anything they want as long as they perform for their managers, labels, patrons, or other business masters. It has been true for many decades that things like unlimited drugs, booze, sex partners, the casting couch, mental illnesses, unreasonable quirks and whims, and related things were just, quote, part of show business. And everyone agreed to cooperate and not make a drama about it. And those who complained or went to law enforcement about it ended their artistic careers, because dozens of aspiring stars who could keep their mouths shut were waiting in the wings to replace them. It hasn't been more than the last decade in which those who got out of control were frequently outed or held accountable in any manner for their actions instead of protected and hidden. Psychologically, it is driven by our fascination with celebrity and power. We have politicians who are treated like celebrities themselves, and we have artists and celebrities who hold no office but are treated like role models and leaders, and people look to them for aspiration and example. We admire them, envy them, and fantasize about their glamour, wealth, and power. So when we find out that they are rude, stuck up, or criminals, or what have you, the illusion breaks, and we can become resentful of that. We emotionally want them to be amazing and perfect, and obviously nobody can live into that forever. But there's a difference to us between simply aging and being unable to deliver, or dropping out of making art, and spoiling it by being a jerk or a toxic asshole or whatever. We want there to be a consequence for the latter, and we make our objections known by our boycotting and our protesting if we are inclined to be unwilling to patronize their art after their personal failings. And I will pause here and see if you care to add anything, Dr. Mathis.
Yeah, the athletic arena is also included in that list.
Ah, yes.
Of folks
that
are,
is very
know, idealized.
That's
right.
Valid. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I
oh God.
That's
yeah.
Valid.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't. We wouldn't have Michael Jordan shoes if that weren't the case. yeah. Just saying. Yeah. I think it's a couple of things. I think part of it is this thing called projective identification. So we see somebody or a group of somebody's doing something, and we admire what they do. We like what they stand for. It reflects some of our own feelings, thoughts, emotions, about attitudes about something. And so we do a projective identification with them. And when they aren't matching up to what our fantasy is, we feel betrayed. And it's almost as if they lied to us. And so now we want to take revenge on them because how dare them despoil our fantasy. And that's really what a lot of this is about, is we're pissed off because we had a fantasy that wasn't right to begin with, and we want to punish them for our irrational fantasy. Right, so that in and of itself is a problem right off the bat there. And, you know, certainly I'm not going to tell you that I don't projectively identify with people, because I do. The only difference is I know I'm doing it. And when I do it and I know I'm doing it, I always kind of have this little voice in the back of my head going, okay, now you like this person, you think they're kind of like you, but don't be shocked if you read the newspaper next week that they robbed, you know, Wells Fargo or blew up Fort Knox or, you know, ran over 3 children in a bus getting away. You can still like what they do artistically, but recognize that they're sociopaths. Yeah, I'm just making this up, obviously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that's hard for folks to do. Because we want to get the emotion thing involved. We want to live fantasy lives through them, kind of like some parents do through their kids' accomplishments. It's the same kind of phenomenon. And we want to punish them when they disabuse us of our fantasy. You know. And so part of that is that. Part of that is we are reminded of perhaps people in our own lives or in our own communities who've done things similar to what these folks have done, and these are reprehensible acts, and we think that all people that do these reprehensible acts should be held accountable, and you know, we kind of go overboard with the punishment routine kind of thing, or the boycotting or the protesting or whatever, and we take it to what I would consider to be ridiculous levels. You know, and again, all of that's because we're involved with our amygdala in it. I keep telling people, reality, not morality, right? If you can look at things for their reality content, you can dislike it, you can disagree with it, you can, you know, be upset about it, whatever, but let's get a reality view of this and not inflict our own personal morality and not punish these people because they had, you know, the audacity to not fulfill our fantasy.
Fair enough. Okay, next question. Under what circumstances should one do this, if ever? And this, again, is a matter of personal ethics and taste and conscience. There is no right answer. It boils down to sentimentality versus investment in the personal character of one's choices of art and entertainment, and is completely subjective. Not much more to say on it in this aspect. And I'll check in with you real quick, see if you do want to add anything.
Yeah, it's emotional reasoning versus rational reasoning.
Yeah.
You know, and everybody's got but everybody has certain things that are triggers for them. Everybody has certain things that they're not willing or able to give up. And, you know, everybody has to make this personal decision for themselves. I personally think it's irrational to do that, but that's just me and I'm a nerd. What do I know, right? Everybody has, but you're right. There's no absolute quote-unquote right or wrong answer to this. You've got to do what your conscience says, but make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. Make sure you're not doing it because you're mad at them for breaking your fantasy.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully after tonight, you know, like you said, you do it too, but you know what's going on. So hopefully our listeners will be equipped after hearing these questions and they'll be able to discern that for themselves.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be great, okay? So, next question. What if those they harmed forgave them? This is a point to consider in any situation in which someone's personal integrity and character matter. So it is naturally relevant to this issue wherever one falls, whether the target is a celebrity or not. Whether or not to measure forgiveness or letting transitions go by the forgiveness and reparations made to those someone else has harmed is a subjective call. Some people have been harmed in similar ways, and the level of psychological work they have done on their own situation may color whether they are ready to move on from the actions of someone not personally involved in their lives, but who may embody or symbolize a past harm or a psychological issue for an individual. And I'm going to check in with you here and see if you care to add anything.
Yeah, and part of that has to do with what I was talking about earlier about the projective identification. It also has to do with people that have been traumatized, and if somebody reenacts something that's symbolic or reminds them of their trauma, they're naturally going to get triggered, then they're going to be all huffy about it. And, you know, that's a fight-or-flight response that their body's trying to protect themselves from. I think when that happens, they need to realize that that's what's going on, and get a handle on it, as opposed to being, you know, angry at the person for triggering them.
Yeah. Okay. So the next question that I want to get into is it a different answer if the artist is merely unpleasant or rude, like they're stuck up or they act like a diva, versus actively harming someone, you know, committing assault or rape or other crimes? Although the general stereotype of overlooking conceit or diva behavior in celebrities and artists still seems to hold true and appears not to have shifted much from how it has almost always been treated, it does appear to be different when there is actual harm or criminal behavior involved. For most people who do feel there should be a consequence tied to their patronage, if an artist is found to have an ethical flaw, the consensus appears that such protests really are only merited in times of extreme ethical lapse or full-on criminal activity involving harm of others. There's a great deal of personal inconvenience, soul-searching, and lifestyle changes involved in a large gesture of boycotting an artist. So it tends not to be a step that individuals are willing to suffer for a small or insignificant infraction. And I'm going to check in with you here and see if you care to add anything to that.
Yeah, what I will say is, in general, I'm a big believer in folks needing to suffer the natural logical consequences of their actions. So I would in no way, shape, or form protect an artist, athlete, politician from criminal prosecution or following up in some sort of heinous activity that they did. I don't think that diminishes their art. So if you want to put them in jail or prison or execute them or whatever, you know, because they, you know, were running a child porn ring, or they were, you know, selling secrets to the Russians, so to speak, or they were, you know, blowing up buildings or whatever, then yeah, okay, great. But that doesn't, you know, if they painted the Mona Lisa while they were doing that, it doesn't diminish the value of the Mona Lisa. It really says more about them. They just happen to be talented, you know, artists who have very nasty character flaws. And I think that we need to be able to separate that out in our heads and still appreciate them for the product that they do, but not necessarily them as a person per se. That's a toughy thing to do. I mean, I'm the first to tell you that's a tough one.
Yeah, and it's not like we are making anybody bad and wrong if they really just don't want to support that person anymore. But their art is still artistic. It's still of whatever merit that it had. But you're not necessarily bad if you don't want to deal with it anymore, if you just cannot stop thinking about the little boy they hurt or whatever happens. All right, so the next question I want to poke is, do we take the same level of rigor with persons in any other jobs or regular shops? Why or why not? So at the risk of sounding repetitive or copping out of answers, this, like most other considerations we're talking about tonight, is morally neutral and ethically individualized and subjective. Some people treat being an artist just like any other job, and so if they found out that their mechanic was a thief or their barber abused their spouse, they would boycott that shop and that person, so in turn they boycott an artist. The difficulty and the difference, at least for some people, is that what is in that creating art is a very different kind of a job than most typical other jobs. Artists, especially well-known ones, tend to be more akin to politicians and, as you observed, you know, athletes in career behavior, which is to say they are immersed completely in being an artist or a politician or an athlete and do not truly enjoy any kind of authentic off mode. Also, who they are personally becomes part of who they at least seem to be or represent professionally. This factor is the one that causes the most dissonance and controversy for people who take umbrage at major character flaws. They feel like a part of the complete image and notion which they appreciate and patronize has now been damaged, and we just talked about this a few minutes ago. Or they resent feeling as if they were fooled somehow. Frequently, protesters are much more personally invested in making the complaints known, when it comes to their arts and entertainment sources. Many seem to feel it reflects on their own character not to take a stand these days. And a lot of that comes from social media pressure. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Matheson, see if you want to add some more to this.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that social pressure in any scenario, whether it's, you know, in your cadre group or on the media, social media, or whatever, certainly buys into this. And the problem that people don't understand is social media is biased by the people that post it. So you're not getting the whole truth all the time, kind of like with certain newscasts. You're not really getting the whole truth. You're getting a biased view of the news. You're not getting, you know, the truth and nothing but the truth to help you, God, Buddha, Satan, all in it, or any other deity, you know. So it's all colored, which is going to color your perception. I also would tell you that some artists, and, you know, when I say artists, I'm using it broadly, dancers, painters, sculptors, musicians, actors,
right,
whatever.
Yes.
You know, can do things in the public eye that are not kosher, and the public seems to go, oh, gosh, you know, poor person. And another artist does it, and they're all over them. I mean, Elvis is a great example of that. You know, when people found out he was a drug addict and all this kind of good stuff, they were like very okay with it. You know, oh gosh, that's so sad, da da da. You know, they weren't going, oh my God, he's a scumbag, he's a drug addict, he's doing this, he's doing that. But gosh, you know, other artists come up with that kind of thing and they get pummeled. So there's not even a uniform standard that people use, even with artists. But they certainly don't hold the average Joe or Jolene to the same level that they do folks in the public eye, so to speak, in whatever variety they might be. And, you know, they have a double standard, very much like we have double standards. Despite all our rhetoric, we have double standards for females in the workplace today, as far as I'm concerned. You know, women aren't getting paid the same as guys are in a lot of ways. I mean, it's ridiculous. They're doing the same goddamn jobs, and why aren't they being paid?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's still that... It's still that dichotomy that happens with folks. And it depends on, is the artist likable or not, or the politician or whatever, or are they not very likable? And, you know, it's so many gosh darn factors. There's no way to say, okay, here's a uniform standard we're going to hold everybody to. I mean, ostensibly, that's what we need to be doing. If we have a rule, the rule's only good if it applies to everybody equally. Right, I don't tell adolescents that I see cut your hair and get a real job. I can, you know, I was that right when I grew my hair long. Right now, what I can do is tell them if you go to Abercrombie and Fitch and try to get a job with blue hair and nose ring, you ain't getting it. Right, and that's why I cut my hair when I went for my internship interview, crying all the way to the barbers and crying all the time I was sitting in the barber's chair. And that's not much of an exaggeration, sad but true. Cannot tell a lie. And, but, you know, I did what I had to do to get the job. And so, you know, I don't tell kids, you know, don't get a tattoo, don't get a nose ring, don't get your hair long, because I lost the right to tell kids not to look different, because I don't look normal. And so, you know, you lose the right to do that, but you can educate people. And if you choose to be different, this is the kind of stuff you're going to get, the flack you're going to get. And this is some of the consequences for your behavior. And if you're willing to take the consequences, okay, great. You know, and I would say the same thing to artists. If you want to, you know, have sex with underage people, or you want to, you know, do things that society normally thinks are not very good, you ought to be held accountable to the same level of justice, if you will, that the rest of us are held to. And if you want to take the risk, go for it.
Fair enough.
That doesn't mean you can't paint really well, or you can't shoot a great basket, or you don't play guitar like a banshee. But you can do it in prison. Yeah.
Alrighty. So the next part I'm going to talk about is, what if the sins or transgressions were a product of a time period or culture? Like ethical relativism. No, wait a minute. Did we just talk about this? No, I did not. Okay.
No.
Sorry. It sounded, I had deja vu for a second. Sorry about that. I apologize. So does this change anything? Does the obligation change when the artist dies or was already dead ages earlier? So this aspect of tonight's discussion seems to be more a matter of politics than psychology, and it can be a complex matter to navigate. Individuals may feel an obligation to avoid what is currently understood to be inappropriate behaviors, and may feel that patronizing art that embodies certain topics is supporting subjects or actions about which we now know better and do not support in real life. One example of this principle in action might be slapping a histrionic woman in the face to snap her out of it, which was a popular trope in the silver screen and film noir eras. We don't condone such things now, but many individuals may feel torn about appreciating art that depicts this behavior, which was considered normal in the time period in which it was made. Another example is that there are multiple scenes in several John Hughes movies, popular in the 80s and 90s, done in a joking or mocking manner that have to do with what amounts to date rape, sex without clear consent, often the target being impaired or tricked in some way. Some people in the present day now feel compelled to boycott these films. This raises another interesting point. For many people, what medium is in play has a lot to do with what they will accept. Some people listen to lyrics about situations or actions that are criminal or harmful, but they object to movies and TV shows showing the same material. Is this a psychological trick we play on ourselves to avoid the discomfort of the topic? Last, as we mentioned earlier, does it matter if the art, the topic, or the artist were of a bygone era and everyone involved was long dead before we even came along? Does this change the nature of our relationship with the material in question? What is psychologically at play here? And I'm going to turn this over to you and see if you care to add anything.
Ooh, I got lots to add to this one.
Oh, here we go.
As you probably... Yeah, I know. Kills the plays, right?
Yeah, as I suspected,
first of all,
and what I mean is hoped.
Well, yeah. So what I'm going to say is anybody who does this, I think, is a complete moron. I'll just say that out loud. You know, we have a lot of these newfound morals and ethics, and I'm not suggesting they're wrong, of what's inappropriate and what's appropriate. And that changes from era to era. You know, 50 years ago, it was okay for therapists to sleep with their patients. That's not kosher anymore. It hasn't been kosher for a while. You know, 50, 60 years ago, it was okay to do terrible things to folks of certain disenfranchised ethnic and racial groups. That's not kosher anymore. So if somebody's doing something that's kosher for the time and you want to punish them for it 50 years later because you realize, hey, you know, that's kind of messed up, you're a moron. You know, you don't punish kids for pooping in their pants when they're 2 years old because they don't know any better. You're going to, you know, an 18-year-old that poops in his pants on purpose, doesn't have diarrhea, isn't sick, just doing it to piss you off or whatever. Yeah, they know better. So it's all relative. The mores of the socioeconomics and sociocultural times dictate behaviors and what's ethically and morally, quote unquote, right or wrong, which is why I've said many times, and I said this in an earlier show, ain't no such thing as ethics and morals. They don't come from God. They are man-made concepts that we do arbitrarily, right, that we enforce on society. And I'm not suggesting we shouldn't have them. I'm not suggesting they're not important. I'm suggesting they aren't manna from God or some other deity being, so we need to stop holding them like that. We need to recognize that they are very, very variable, that they change with the political climate, they change with the knowledge about human beings and what's quote-unquote appropriate and what's not appropriate. And, you know, ought we be holding current people to those standards? Well, duh, right? Mm-hmm. But holding somebody 300 years ago, being pissed off because somebody owned slaves 300 years ago when it was perfectly normal, do you forget that biblical characters owned slaves? Are you going to burn the Bible too? Come on, people, get a brain. Get a brain.
There are people who have called for that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and I, you know, people who want to do that, I just really want to bitch slap the crap out of them, frankly, and go, wake the hell up and stop being a moron. Really? You're going to change the name of buildings because somebody, you know, pooped on the side of the wall, on a sidewalk 100 years ago when it was considered okay to do that? Really? What are we going to say about us 100 years from now that we're talking about stuff that we shouldn't be talking about and people are going, whoa, those were bad people? You know, we do the best we can with what we got and with the information that we have. And that's all that any of us can do because none of us are perfect. None of us are God or God-like. We do the best of what we got. Some of us work harder at it than others, but to try to punish somebody, you know, or hold somebody accountable for new socio-cultural standards now that were not even in anybody's delusional awareness 50, 100, 200, 300 years ago, that's crazy by anybody's definition. Crazy. And if we're wanting to do that, I think there's something missing in us that we're wanting to take the focus off of us and, you know, punish somebody else or put somebody else down to make us feel better because we have self-esteem issues, self-efficacy issues, self-worth issues, self-confidence issues, whatever. And, you know, it's kind of like the line from Julius Caesar, you know, where Mark Anthony says, you know, the problem, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. And I think that's where we need to start looking and stop pointing fingers at everybody else. And remember that when you're pointing a finger at somebody, I hate to sound trite, you got four more fingers pointing back at you. So, FYI, people.
I'm watching my pointing hand right now. Actually, my thumb's going forward, but...
Oh, there you go. I'm going to point with a straight hand. Like I'm going to slap your ass.
Ooh, hey. All right.
So I think that's the issue. I'm not suggesting we have to like it. And, you know, but come on, people. Let's get real here.
All right. So in summary with this, you know, there are psychological principles behind individual choices regarding subject matter or the ethics of the artist behind the work, but there's not one unified reaction or stance on the matter. And additionally, there's the consideration that art is ultimately under absolutely no obligation whatsoever to relegate itself to so-called safe topics or subjects. And so there is a divide between unsafe topics and unsafe artists outside of their works. Just so you guys are clear on this, works of art will always cover some topics of societal discomfort. In fact, many artists feel that that is one of art's chief purposes, or at least it is for them. So tonight's focus is more on addressing topics related to the human creator rather than the works themselves, and we hope that we have raised some useful questions for individuals to consider as they navigate their relationships with whatever works of art they choose to enjoy. So I'm going to see if there's anything that you would like to further address on any part of this that we've talked about this evening.
I've probably said way too much for some people already.
Fair enough.
Not that that ever stopped me. Yeah, and it's funny because one of the comments you made was part of the point of the Mapplethorpe exhibit back in the 90s.
Which point?
About art as a way to shock people and to get people to think about stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And that's a very good example.
Yeah,
I was actually, when you were saying that, I was also kind of thinking there was a work of art done in Australia in the 90s, and I used to work for a major news agency a long time ago, and this story came across my desk because I was doing the Australian news feeds, and it was a photograph that was manipulated, and the work of art was called Piss Christ, and it was a crucifix diffused in a beaker of urine. And this sounds...
I've heard about that, yeah.
But the photography and the actual art itself was very interesting. But, you know, the title and making sure people knew what it was part of the art to be shocking and to get people's panties all up in a twist about it because, you know, religion and all of this stuff. And there was a huge scandal. I was kind of looking at the picture and I was like, well... You know, the title's kind of rude, but it's very interesting. And the title's part of the art. It's not just looking at the picture. It's knowing what that is and being told in the title what that is. That's part of it. And there's always going to be art that's like that. There's been piss Christs in every era of art, I'm sure. I'm not savvy enough to remember all the titles of things like that, but... You know, that is a separate thing from what we're talking about as far as artist being a certain way. And then even then, you kind of have to navigate your own wheelhouse on there. But one of the important things I think to take away from it is that if people want to go ahead and look at the art or appreciate the movie or the book or the dance or something, even though the person who put it out there is a raving asshole and really should be in jail, it's okay for them to do that, even if it's not okay for you to do that. Like, if you can't handle it, that's fine. You know, sell the record to somebody and give the CD away or whatever you got to do. But that's about you and your relationship with the art, and it's not an obligation for everyone.
Right.
And
well, that's kind of like when people misinterpreted John Lennon's quote about them being more popular than Jesus Christ. And then he went and burned all the Beatle records. And, you know, they totally took that out of context.
Yeah. You know, that's something that's pretty much going to happen with popular music ever. Like, people are going to... Okay, so
yeah.
Psychologically, what is that that people have this need to pitchfork everything? Like, what is that for people?
Well, again, it's they're wanting to punish people to get the flashlight away from them. They want to take the spotlight off of their shit. If they're, you know, they can, it's like, you know, focusing on a common enemy to bring people together, and you don't have to look at your stuff. You don't have to own it. You don't have to talk about why it makes you uncomfortable and what is it about it that you find disquieting, and, you know, it's blaming other people, and it's blaming other people for your stuff instead of owning it. It serves a multiplicity of purposes, none of which are very good.
I was going to say, almost all of which sound toxic.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Because they are.
Yeah, because well-adjusted people don't run around and do that crap very often.
Yes, that is correct.
Yes, all right. So, fair enough. If there is nothing else to add, that's pretty much the extent of my notes on this. And so hopefully
change stuff like we usually do.
Yeah.
We cool.
You know, it all kind of evens out, but you know, hopefully we have been able to equip everybody to understand what this process is for them. And wherever you are on the spectrum, if you want to enjoy the art, then now you can kind of think about it. And if you don't want to enjoy the art anymore, then, you know, you can think about that too. So,
right.
More or less, this concludes our show on separating art from the artist. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation also to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks on Wednesday, March 20th, 11 p.m., and it'll be Eastern Daylight Time because the clocks change and spring forward on this coming Sunday, March 10th. Don't forget,
barf.
Right here on Blog Talk. Yeah, I know. Right here on blogtalkradio.com. So our own upcoming shows, as I mentioned, include March 20th, episode 65 for a topic to be discussed later. We will work on that for you. We also want to give a shout out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow on Travel Itch Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, it will be Dan Schlossberg and Anita Stokes-Thomas interviewing Rick Netzel, Director of Sales and Marketing for the Palm Lakes Best Western in West Palm Beach. And then followed by The Edge of Reality at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, special guest Jillian Larson will be chatting Reality Rally 2019. And then I will have my other radio show on Sunday, March 10th, 8:30 p.m., The Walking Dead Online Viewing Party, Season 9, Episode 13. The episode's called Choke Point. So please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.